I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca road, when along came a semi with a high end canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man, I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man, I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man, I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa.
Good evening, Vashon Island. I am Megan Hastings, and this is the Cats and Jammer Follies, a travel story show. And today we have a good friend of mine on. Her name is Jen Huntley. She is both a prolific, beautiful painter, just finished a show at Snapdragon. And she was a professor of history for many years down in California, and in Nevada. Jen is on the show today to tell us some wild and crazy stories of her travel from her youth. Jen, join us. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks, Megan.
Thank you for coming on the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
So we're going to start off. She lived in China during the Tiananmen Square protests in 1989. And that in of itself is just an amazing story. I can't even believe that you were there. And she captured it beautifully with photographs and written words. Mm-hmm. Not that you're going to share those with us today. You're going to verbally share your mm-hmm. tales with us. Mm-hmm. What brought you there?
I was actually living in Taiwan. Mm-hmm. I lived in Taiwan for 2.5, almost 3 years, and saved up my money and had decided that I was going to take the Trans-Siberian train.
Oh God, I want to
across
do that.
Russia, which is an old dream of mine from taking Russian history in college, and I had been hired to teach in Greece, on an island in Greece. And so I was leaving Asia, leaving Taiwan, where I had taught English mm-hmm. as a second language for 3 years, going to mainland China to catch the Trans-Siberian train and then travel across to Europe. And at the same time, while I was living in Taiwan, which was essentially under martial law while I lived there, mm-hmm. In addition to teaching English, I had a job as a journalist for the Free China News, Free China Daily News.
And what is that?
That was an English language newspaper that...
For expats,
that's right.
And just people that wanted to.
Yeah, and it was published in Taiwan, had an English language editor, but all of the writers and reporters were Chinese. Taiwan was originally colonized by China, and so most of the people who live there speak Chinese Mandarin.
Not Taiwanese.
Right. Taiwanese is like the native population of Taiwan, which is a different language. So
that's got to have a culturally staggering divide there.
It's interesting. I'm actually not very well positioned to talk about it in detail, mm-hmm. but there are parallels to some degree between Native Americans in this country and Native Taiwanese in Taiwan versus the Chinese dominant Mandarin speaking people. So anyway, the newspaper position that I had, which was basically to translate, to take reports that had been written in English by native Chinese speakers and make the English more like standard English. And so, okay. You know, there's like the derogatory term is Chinglish or
yeah.
Chingrish. So my job was to take their English reporting and edit it, essentially. And because of that, because I had that position, I was able to access a lot more international newspapers than were available on the street in Taiwan. Because most, you know, we didn't, it was just an extremely different time as far as news is concerned. We had the Herald, International Herald Tribune,
mm-hmm.
Newsport News, which was a combination of the New York Herald and the New York Tribune. But other than that, we didn't have access to most major news. Like, it wasn't anything like today.
Yeah, of course. I mean, people still actually read newspapers. There was no internet.
Correct. There was no, absolutely no internet. Yeah. So because I had access to like the Free China Daily News, I could see what was happening. I read every day what was happening in Tiananmen Square in China, which just happened to be the students were just starting their protests as we were planning to leave Taiwan.
Because it went on for a couple months, right?
Yes.
I mean, before it really exploded.
It started in April. The protest started in April of 1989, and the army finally closed in on the students on June 3rd and 4th of 1989.
So for those people out there that might be too young to remember this or mm-hmm. just don't know the history of it, what exactly were the students protesting? What was this whole thing about?
That's a really interesting question, actually, because... It's hard to really pinpoint that. But essentially what happened, and I just want to say to all the listeners out there that I'm doing this off the seat of my pants. I have not had time to go back and do the research on this.
It is true. So, she got asked last minute yesterday, although I've been trying to have her on the show for months.
So Megan's throwing me a little bit of a softball there. I'll see if I can BS my way through here.
I think you can. I've got confidence in you.
So as I recall, in April, there was a high-level Chinese Communist Party official whose name, I think, was Hu Huawei. And in protest, he was either pushed out or voluntarily stepped down from a position of power. And I don't remember what the issue was. Or maybe, hang on, now I'm rethinking this. He died. A person died.
Okay.
And there was a funeral. So it started as a funeral ceremony for this person who had passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And then as there was a reshuffling of power, and there was a person who came into power or who ascended in some way, and his name was Li Peng. And the students did not like him, and they did not like what he represented. And I cannot, for the life of me, remember enough about
the specifics
of it.
Yeah, sure, that's okay.
But I remember Li Peng because when we went to Hong Kong, which is where we had to go first, we had to fly out of Taiwan, go to Hong Kong, and then fly from Hong Kong to Beijing. There were T-shirts in the store that said "Li Peng, step down. Please step down." So they were agitating for this person to step down,
mm-hmm.
kind of like Andrew Cuomo, but not for the same reason.
For other weird reasons.
Yeah, right. So that's what I remember as the gist of the cause. And then the students came in and were protesting in Tiananmen Square, and they started setting up camps in Tiananmen Square. And I do remember that one of the things that was really momentous that got this protest onto the international radar was the visit from the Russian premier at that time, whose name was...
Was it Gorbachev?
Gorbachev.
Yeah.
Mikhail Gorbachev.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. And he visited China, and it was considered to be the students being in the square while he was visiting was considered to be shameful to the people in power.
Oh, I can imagine that would not go down well.
Right. So anyway,
How long were you set up? Because you also set up camp, right?
I didn't set up camp, but we visited the camp every single day.
Because I've seen some of the photos that Jen took. And Yeah, there were a lot of camps that were set up all around the square.
Oh, yeah, it was filled.
Yeah, it was filled.
So we were there for 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason we were there for so long, I was traveling with two other American companions, one of whom had been another one of my roommates, and then the other person was another American teacher who I taught English with. And the way things worked back then in the communist world is for a Westerner, in order to get a visa to go into a country, you had to have a visa out of the country. So you had to set up all your visas going backwards. So the last communist country we were going to be in was Yugoslavia. So we had to get an exit visa out of Yugoslavia,
mm-hmm.
then Hungary, then Russia, then China, and work backwards. So, and all we had were these extremely rickety bicycles that we rode around Beijing on bicycles to go to these various embassies and work on getting all of our stamps into our passport.
Right.
So every day, so that was a 10-day process, and we went through Tiananmen Square every single day, talked to students.
And were you actually there? It's June 4th was the big clash.
The early in the morning of June 4th, but it started June 3rd, and we left on June 3rd. So, what
for your own safety, I imagine.
No, it was just planned. It just so happened that was the day that we had our train tickets for. Like, the Trans-Siberian only left town, I think, twice a week. So you had to do it. So the first day that we were there, we figured out, we calculated all of this visa stuff, and then we figured out what day we would be leaving, and we got our train tickets.
Mm-hmm. But you must have felt that energy that it was going to just blow up.
No, you know what? I was really naive and innocent, and I actually remember that we were resting in the shade of the Forbidden City, which was literally forbidden at that point in time. They had army people inside, and they had locked the gates, so there was no tourism into Forbidden City, which is right across the
square, right?
Boulevard from Tiananmen Square. So it was hot, it was sunny, and we were sitting in the shade, and this ABC news reporter, Steve Fetterman, came up to us and started interviewing us. And he asked me, did I think that they were going to bring the army back in? Because what had happened is the army had come in and attempted to clean out the square either right before or right after Gorbachev's visit. And the people of Beijing had surrounded the students, and they had
to protect them.
And they had talked the army people, the soldiers, out of attacking the students. And so they had retreated to the outskirts of the city. That happened before I got there. So anyway, Steve Fetterman asked me, well, do you think they're getting ready to do something like this again? And I said, nah.
Famous last words.
Right. Do not ask for me to predict weather. So, but the reason I said that is because we had been there for almost, you know, probably 5 days at that stage, or mm-hmm. maybe even a whole week. And day by day, fewer and fewer students were in the square. They had kind of fizzled out. And they were going home, and they were packing up their camps.
Oh, you really didn't feel.
So
like
it
that
didn't
energy.
Feel there was at night the energy was really different.
Mm-hmm.
Like during the day, it was kind of like there was sort of a festival feel to it almost. But at night, they had these speakers that were just blaring government propaganda really loudly and really bright. Like Klieg lights shining down on the student camp.
Wow.
So it was a much more tense feeling at night than during the day, but we didn't really go there at night very often. So
how many students do you think were in that square?
Thousands, tens of thousands. I mean, yeah. they think that The report is that they probably killed and or incarcerated about 3,600 was the last number I recall.
God, that's just a,
so I think there were 10,000 or more students that were encamped there at the peak. I would have to go back and look. Are we running out of time? So so anyway, what happened was the last day we were there, I had some, I went out on my creaky old bicycle and did a couple of errands, and I noticed that there were some crowds that were kind of assembling in different parts, but my Chinese wasn't good enough to figure out what it was. And we had secured a van to take us to the train station.
Mm-hmm.
My two companions and I, we had dinner. We got our backpacks, got in the van, started driving down the road, and we got to the end of the road, and we saw a line of army personnel carriers going, stretching as far as the eye could see. And at that point in time, we were like, huh, only we use different words to say that.
Much more colorful.
Yes.
Words.
And the and the driver was like, no problem, no problem. So he like goes down a side road and he turns around and there's another line of army personnel.
I mean, what did you feel when you saw that? That's so intimidating.
For me personally, I was like super excited because I was always had this fantasy that I would be like this crazy ass journalist. And I thought, oh, this is like my year of living dangerously moment. And I grabbed my camera and I started taking all these pictures that you've seen.
Right.
And this happened, a variation of this happened a couple times. This van driver would be like going down alleys and come around. And what was happening is the city bus drivers had parked their buses in a U shape around the major intersections, locking these caravans into place. They couldn't go forward and they couldn't go back. And they had ripped the gearboxes out of the buses. So nobody could like just get into the bus and drive it off. And that's what we saw. And then the last time, the last intersection where we saw this, people coming home from work were pulling the canvas up off of these army personnel carriers and pulling soldiers out. And when we saw that,
wow,
the drivers of the van said, oh, here's your destination. We'll pay us and we'll let you off here. And my traveling companion, whose Chinese was much better than that, said, no, using more colorful language than no. not no, but hell no. You're taking us to the train station and we are not paying you until we are at the train station.
Wow.
And so we did manage to get to the train station. We managed to catch the train. And that was the last we saw of Beijing.
Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution, sounds like a whisper. Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution, sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds whispered. Who are people gonna rise up and get their share?
Jen, that's an amazing story. Like, how incredible that you would be there at that moment in time to capture that bit of history, Chinese history, world history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know?
World history.
Yeah.
Yeah. There is something that I do want to say before we move on to another topic.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, I mentioned that I like had imagined myself as a journalist. So I spent a lot of time interviewing students in the square. And two things really stood out to me. One was they were more familiar with our history than most young Americans at that time, and certainly now. They could quote Thomas Jefferson. They knew, they talked about the Federalist Papers. I mean, they were just extremely well read about our history.
Wow.
But the second thing was, is
I'm pretty sure that, yeah, American kids, I mean, there's a lot of kids here, especially in Vashon, that are very intelligent and want the knowledge. But then there's the rest of the country that doesn't know anything about other countries' history.
We're not actually a historically minded society, and a lot of other societies are.
Yeah.
But the other thing that really struck me, because I would start drilling down into why are you guys actually here? Like they would say, well, we want Li Peng to step down. Okay, but why? Like, what is the end game? Are you trying to get rid of the Communist Party? And they would say, no, we like the Communist Party. We like being communists. We just don't like this one guy. And then I would say, but what is it that you want? And finally, this one guy said to me very clearly, I want to be able to drive a BMW. He said, I am a medical student. I'm studying to be a doctor. And I can't enjoy what that means materially, like a doctor
well,
in America could.
Not living in a communist country.
Right.
So was he one of the kids that said he enjoyed being a communist, though?
Yeah.
Huh, because that kind of goes against all of that.
Well.
Unless you're in the government, of course.
Well, this is a longer discussion. I mean,
yeah, of course.
But Chinese communism is not anti-materialistic. Anyway, I found that really striking, and I thought that was a really interesting thing, and I've always kind of mulled over what does that actually mean.
So it's not anti-materialistic the way that it would be, like in Eastern Europe or Russia.
Right. Yeah.
So that's interesting. I don't think I realized that. So speaking of Russia, I want to hear briefly your Trans-Siberian train experience.
All right. Well, we got on the Trans-Siberian train and,
from Beijing.
And, the first thing we noticed was there were samovars, the tea making devices at the end of every car. On the Trans-Siberian train, all of the expats, all the Westerners were in two cars. Maybe there were three at the end of the train. Then there was Chinese cars, and then there were Russian cars. So people were separated by nationality.
Oh,
in
interesting.
Different cars. Which meant that we were traveling for 8 days with some really interesting people.
And they were?
From all over. From England all over. Yeah. And France and Canada. We were super excited to sit down at the in the dining car, which had white linen tablecloths, and it had these beautiful glasses. And we thought, wow, we're not going to have to eat Kung Pao chicken anymore with chopsticks. And we open up this beautiful menu that has page after page of delicacies of chicken cordon bleu and blah, blah, blah. And so we start ordering these from the waitress, and she'd say, oh, no, we're out of that. 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 And what we discovered is what they had was borscht and pickled herring.
Well,
so for 8 days.
You ate borscht and pickled herring. Oh.
I did not eat pickled herring. I love borscht. I still love borscht to this day. And that was all I ate.
That's pretty amazing that you still love it. I don't know that I could eat borscht for 8 solid days.
Well, the breakfast menu was a little different. Anyway.
What was on the breakfast menu?
I don't remember, honestly, to tell you the truth. I think it was
something else.
Eggs and yogurt.
So you start in China, obviously, and then walk us through the countries that you go through.
So there's a Mongolian route and a Manchurian route. I don't know what of this is still true, because this was back when it was the Soviet Union. And,
right.
And
yeah.
It has broken up since. So I don't even know if this can, I don't even know if the Trans-Siberian train still exists.
I think it does.
Because
I'm going to take it one day.
It was 8 days, and it was June, and the weather was lovely. It was very far north, so it was light, you know,
most
of the time, like in Alaska. The countryside is really, is not stunning. It was a lot of rolling hills, like the American Midwest, I would say. Except for the country around Lake Baikal. And I really remember Lake Baikal left this huge impression on me because...
And where is that?
Uzbekistan? I'm not entirely sure. Lake Baikal is... I think we were had been on the train 3 or 4 days. It's just extremely beautiful and it's extremely big. And I remember waking up and seeing it rolling by the window, and it was, I was really struck by it.
Sounds beautiful.
It's really pretty.
I want to look that up.
There, when we got towards, more towards Moscow, it became very industrialized, very dirty. There was a lot of soot in the air. That was really noticeable. And then we went to Moscow, and we were in Moscow overnight.
Did you get out?
Yes. But the other thing I want to say is, also, there were no cell phones back then, and in these countries, there were you could only make a phone call from an official phone call office, and it was closed on Saturday, which was the day we arrived. So my family and all of my friends were 8 days not knowing where I was.
Oh, God, and they must have been sick.
They had gotten the news. They knew I was there, but they had gotten the news about what happened to the students, but they didn't know what happened to me. And also on that, during that time, there was a huge explosion on a different train in Russia that killed 800 people that was misreported in the American news as the Trans-Siberian train blowing up.
Oh, my God.
So I wasn't able to actually talk to my parents until I got to Budapest. And I called from a payphone, and my dad picked up the phone, and I said, "Hi, Dad." And he said, "When are you coming home?"
Oh. Yeah, I can imagine he was ready to have
now that
back.
I have 20 something old kids of my own. I know exactly how he felt.
How old were you on this trip?
26.
26. That's a good age for travel.
Yeah.
I mean, all the ages are good ages.
Yes. That's
totally.
That's totally true.
So was it, it's so funny because in my head, I always have a vision of the Trans-Siberian train as being kind of bleak.
Mm-hmm.
Is it or no? Because you're...
I think it would totally depend on what the weather is like outside.
Yeah. What is it actually like when you go through Siberia?
Siberia was lovely. It was the middle of summer.
Yeah.
You know, so there are wildflowers and there's birch trees and there, every once in a while you see a domed, you know, Eastern Orthodox church in a village popping up in the distance, and it was quite pretty actually.
It sounds beautiful.
Yeah.
And where did you end up then? Where did you get off the train?
I got off the Trans-Siberian train in Moscow. I got on a train that went to Budapest.
Okay.
I had another friend from college who was living in Budapest at that time. So I think we might have spent almost a week there. Whole nother story. That was the opening of Hungary.
The time.
Funeral of Nagy Imre, which is a whole nother story. And then got on that train and got on the train in Budapest, went through Yugoslavia to Athens. And then I was off trains for quite a time.
Jen, I want to thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
I've been everywhere.
I'm Megan Hastings, and this is the Cats and Jammer Follies. Thank you so much, Vashon, and join us next week for another episode. You have.